high school boys and girls are having a hop at the local soda fountain. Innocently, they dance. Innocent of a new and deadly menace lurking behind closed doors. Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
This is Lowercase Truth.
Public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
And so, would you say that the war on drugs has been a failure?
If its goal is to stamp out drug use, the production and the importation of drugs, then absolutely it's been a failure.
Canadian lawmakers yesterday voted to nationally legalize recreational marijuana, which makes sense considering their prime minister is already smoking.
We should acknowledge that, you know, Justin Trudeau can stand up and tell Canadians that he's used cannabis while sitting as an MP and use that as a reason that they should elect him on a promise that he'll legalize and then become prime minister of the country. And other people have criminal records for this and their lives have been irreparably damaged.
Welcome back to Lowercase Truth. I'm your host, Maggie Reed, and I've been thinking a lot lately about drugs. This past weekend was 420, one of my favorite national holidays, and it was the first 420 in Canada since weed has been legalized. So where are we at with weed? I really don't think that society has fully accepted it in the ways that we accept things like alcohol or tobacco as just kind of fixtures in our world. I think that there's kind of still a ways to go in terms of public perception about weed. And this kind of goes to show you just how much the war on drugs has really impacted us and the way that we think about drugs. We accept certain drugs in society as fine despite their potential harms and consequences, but we don't accept others. And part of the reason for this is that there have been major efforts historically to criminalize and stigmatize the use of some drugs while normalizing the use of other drugs. The United States has been waging a war, a global war on drugs, since the 1970s, when Richard Nixon declared drug abuse public enemy number one. And this war meant that drugs were treated primarily as a crime problem, not a public health problem. And billions of dollars have been spent every year on policing, on courts, and on prisons. The war on drugs has led to mass incarceration in the United States and around the world for drug-related offenses. What it has not done is stop the use, the production, or the importation of drugs. So I think maybe it's a good time to ask whether we should be pursuing these types of policies and this type of spending. We're definitely seeing a shift in thinking around this, starting with cannabis. As many of you know, Canada has now legalized cannabis as of October 17th of 2018, as have many other countries and US states. And for many people who had been using cannabis products without consequence anyway, maybe you felt like it was pretty much already legal. Legalization was pretty anticlimactic, your life didn't really change at all. You're still going to that illegal dispensary around the corner that somehow stays in business. No one really gets how. But if you felt this way, you have to know that while weed was illegal in Canada, there were profound inequalities in the enforcement of our pot laws. Racialized groups, particularly Black and Indigenous groups, have been targeted the most by the war on weed, despite similar rates of drug use amongst all racial groups. This was and is a highly discretionary offense, so the police can really decide to look the other way, or not. And right now, even though weed is legal in Canada, hundreds of thousands of Canadians still have cannabis-related possession offenses on their records. This means that people who were over-policed when pot was illegal are now disadvantaged in being able to participate in its legal status. So setting up a business and kind of making a go of it in the newfound legal weed industry. My guest today speaks with me about how racialized groups have been targeted and impacted the most by the war on drugs. and why he believes that the proper response from the government would be to eradicate all cannabis possession records permanently. And further, he thinks that we should legalize other recreational drugs, all recreational drugs, in fact, not just cannabis.
So, my name is Akwasio Wusubempa. I'm a sociologist at the University of Toronto. I consider myself a criminologist. I study mostly issues related to race, crime, and criminal justice, and particularly policing.
We see drugs represented in pop culture a lot. You know, I think of, there's all sorts of drug shows, Breaking Bad, Narcos. We're often, I mean, there might be problems in the portrayals, say what you will about them, but, you know, the war on drugs typically isn't portrayed in the best light in a lot of these shows. Like, it's not portrayed as effectual, let's put it that way. So I just want to ask you, how's the war on drugs been going?
I guess that depends on who you are. But overall, I would say not well if your goal is to stamp out drug use, importation, production. Like, if you're a policing agency and you want to get lots of resources in terms of both, like, money and equipment, then it has for a long time, or had for a long time, been going quite well. Because as the war on drugs ramped up, there were more funds and more resources allocated to fighting that war. So I think one of the interesting things to point out now, as we move to this era in which we're seeing cannabis legalization here in Canada, of course, as well as across many American states, other jurisdictions in South and Central America and Europe seemingly going the same way, is to remember that for most of human history, drugs were not illegal, right? It's only in the past century and a little bit beyond that drugs, you know, things like heroin and cocaine were actually made illegal. Canada started with the Opium Act of 1908. Cannabis followed not too long after. There'd been some criminalization in the United States of drugs in the late 1800s and certainly around the same period. It was really in the 1970s and early 1980s that the war on drugs as we know it now ramped up. So first Nixon declaring drug abuse public enemy number one in the United States. And then Ronald and importantly, Nancy Reagan ramping up the war on drugs and allocating more resources and I think public airtime and space to this idea that drugs are a menace, drug use is a menace, and it's something that needs to be stamped out in our society.
And so was that the goal, to stamp out use?
I think that would depend on who you ask, right? Like when we look at how drug law enforcement has actually played out, we know in Canada, for example, like the Opium Act of 1908 was designed specifically to target the Asian population. So there was concern about Asian migrants who'd come to help build the railroad, and they're competing with white Canadians for jobs. Opium use was associated with or attached to the Asian population. The drug was criminalized and enforcement was directed at Asian users. Similarly in the United States, right? It's called marijuana, derived from Spanish rather than its scientific name, cannabis, specifically because, again, the use of the drug was associated with Mexican people and they were also competition for labor. And so by criminalizing the substance and associating the use of that substance with a particular group, you can then effectively criminalize that group. And that's what we've seen across time, is that although drug use is relatively similar across different racial groups, who gets charged, arrested, and incarcerated for using those drugs certainly differs based on racial background.
And so would you say that the war on drugs has been a failure?
If its goal is to stamp out drug use, the use, the production, and the importation of drugs, then absolutely it's been a failure.
Sometimes we hear kind of arguments made that it's about kind of the health implications. Was it ever about health? You know, that it's really, you know, not good to be consuming these drugs and that we need people to stop using them because it's a health risk. Do you buy that?
I don't buy that, largely because alcohol and tobacco are two of the most harmful drugs to individual and social health. In terms of, we think about alcohol, it's not just yourself that you're harming through using that drug, but also people that are injured in accidents and crashes and things like that. So, like, I think that's a broad question you've asked, and I'm sure there are people across time that have been genuinely concerned about the health implications of drugs. I think one of the key things is that there's been a lot of misinformation spread about drugs, right? About how harmful drugs are, especially the Just Say No and the here's your brain on drugs advertisements that many of us remember from when we were young, right? Like that sends a picture that the drug use is quite harmful.
If you haven't seen these ads, the This Is Your Brain on Drugs ads were part of a large-scale U.S. anti-narcotics campaign by a Partnership for a Drug-Free America. And here's one of those ads featuring Rachel Lee Cook from the movie She's All That.
This is your brain.
It's actually an egg.
And this is heroin.
It's actually a frying pan.
This is what happens to your brain after snorting heroin.
Okay, so now she's hitting the egg, obviously.
And this is what your body goes through. Wait, it's not over yet. This is what your family goes through.
Oh, okay, now she's just smashing everything in the room.
And your life.
Okay.
Any questions?
Yeah, I think we have like a couple questions, Rachel Lee Cook, but back to health.
And so I'm sure there are some people that have been advocating for drug prohibition who come to that from a genuine concern for health. But like when we look at the science, there's a relatively eminent scientist in the United Kingdom who was famously kicked off of a governmental drug advisory panel for stating that horseback riding was more dangerous than the use of ecstasy in the United Kingdom. Because when he actually took a look at the numbers, more people were harmed from horseback riding than were harmed from the use of ecstasy.
So it sounds like there's kind of a problem of perception, if I could call it that, because so maybe people, as you say, are concerned with health, but if we actually look at the things that we deem to be legal that are harmful and we accept those in society, is there an incongruency here? Like,
well, there is. We've got to remember that alcohol was illegal for a period of time as well, right? Like, we had alcohol prohibition here in Canada, it was the same in the United States, and so, you know, that drug as well has been criminalized at a point in our history. I think with many drugs, and you know, there's some debate around this, like the fact that cannabis, for example, has been illegal for so long to an extent has stifled research on its effects. So there's been, you know, there are tens of thousands of papers that have researched, you know, scientific and social scientific studies on cannabis that have been published. But I think we could know a lot more about the drug and how it affects us long term had it not been illegal and it been subject to even further scientific research.
Right. So its illicit status has kept it from actually being properly researched.
Because part of the illicit status is the control of the drug, right? So in Canada, we got the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. Similar things in the United States in terms of scheduling of drugs. And so when drugs are controlled in such a way, then yeah, access to those substances for research is also curtailed.
Of course, if U.S. news has you down, you can just head up north. Because as of today, Canada has officially legalized recreational pot.
On October 17th, 2018, Justin Trudeau's Liberal government delivered on their promise to legalize recreational weed. Many states in the U.S. have also done this, and it seems like the tides might be turning. I talked to Akwasi about whether he thinks this is a step in the right direction towards ending the war on drugs.
Absolutely, it's a step in the right direction, and one that I think was like 100 or so years too late. Like, I don't think that the drug ever should have been criminalized. As I noted, I'm a race and justice scholar. It's very difficult to study race and justice, race and policing without studying drugs. And that became readily apparent to me in undergrad. I took a fourth year law class actually entitled Drugs User in the State. And this was right around the time that we were starting to see legal cannabis for medical purposes, like the regime, one of our past regimes, emerge. And so it's great now to see, as a researcher and someone who truly believes that the harms of prohibition far outweigh the costs of having drugs be legal. It's nice now to see that cannabis legalization is here. I'm glad Justin Trudeau used that as part of his election platform, admitted to having used it himself, and they followed through and that we have that. And again, also, I'm very happy to see that it appears to be coming in other jurisdictions. And, you know, I don't think the United States is very far off either.
So you obviously see this as a positive step, okay? So, and I do think, I don't know if it's fair to say, but, you know, there's been a long-term destigmatization of marijuana, we could say, you know, that it wasn't just, you know, it was a long process, as you kind of just pointed out. But in your research and your advocacy, you kind of talk about the fact that it's not just a matter of legalizing marijuana and that that's enough, that we actually need to kind of make reparations for some of the injustices that we've seen from it, from its illicit status. So can you talk about those reparations that you are kind of asking for, and yeah, maybe give us a sense of that.
Absolutely. So I think interesting on the stigmatization point, like things have definitely changed since the movie Reefer Madness was,
yeah,
you know, launched or whatever decades ago. I think we still got a long way to go in terms of removing some of the stigma around cannabis use. And I think as more people and parents and whatever else have conversations with their children and you know, admit to use publicly, and as the way in which we can use the drug changes as well, so I'm thinking here edibles and topicals and things like that, that that'll change more. But your question was about reparations, and I think in order to answer that properly, like I again need to point to the fact that drug law enforcement in this country has been so heavily racialized. Like, I am convinced that our drug laws were developed to specifically target and control specific racialized populations. Unfortunately, in the Canadian context, unlike the US and the United Kingdom, like our government and our criminal justice agencies don't systematically collect, and when they do collect, they don't systematically make public racially desegregated criminal justice data, meaning that unlike the US or the UK, we can't simply go to the FBI or the Home Office's website and see a racial breakdown of individuals who've been arrested or convicted, for example, of specific drug crimes. So that means that we actually don't know how heavily racialized our drug law enforcement has been, with the exception of the few studies that have been done, largely actually by journalists. So okay. Jim Rankin at the Toronto Star and one of his colleagues got access to cannabis possession arrest data from Toronto for a decade period. And we see very clearly there that African Canadians, so black people in the city, were greatly overrepresented in arrests, and that the growth in cannabis arrests worked in tandem with the growth in carding, the, you know, discriminatory police stop and search practice that we hear a lot about. And then Rachel Brown at Vice News got a hold of cannabis arrest data from several cities across the country. And we got to see there, literally from coast to coast, the black and indigenous people were overrepresented in arrests for minor cannabis possession. So that's a highly discretionary offense. Some of my own research has shown that racial differences, or that there are little in the way in racial differences in use. So while there are great differences in arrests, racial groups use at relatively similar rates, suggesting that there's discrimination in the way that the laws have been enforced. The disparities, racial disparities that we see in other areas of the Canadian criminal justice system are reflected in the little bit of data that we have around drugs as well. And so I've noted, you know, we talk about the war on drugs being a failure. Like there have been, and even in Canada, it's estimated that enforcing like our old cannabis laws could have cost law enforcement and the justice system up to $1 billion a year, right? So as I've said before, that's money that's, you know, largely given to police, courts, and corrections to create havoc oftentimes and really harm disadvantaged communities. So we give money to the police, courts, and corrections instead of schools, hospitals, and community centers. And so when we talk about reparations, the people that are given criminal records for things like minor cannabis possession, even though that's a relatively common and minor crime, still have trouble, for example, perhaps getting financial aid to go to school, being admitted to certain post-secondary programs, of course, have trouble with employment. You know, if your job will not hire someone with a criminal record or an employer. And also, we know with regards to housing. So it can have a large impact, not only on individuals, but of course, then their families and communities.
Are we talking, we're talking drug possession here.
We're talking drug possession.
Drug possession. Yes. So literally having marijuana, being caught with smoking it or having it on you, and this is affecting your life in these ways.
And it's funny because, you know, we're on campus at the University of Toronto, right? Like I've got many friends that like live and grew up in the area around here. And as I started having conversations about legalization with some of them, they said, well, isn't cannabis already legal?
Right.
And that's because for some people in this country, like even if they had been caught with cannabis before, as I said, it's a highly discretionary crime, and the police, and I'm sure leading up to legalization, every single day in this country, the police came across people who were in possession of small quantities of cannabis, and they let those people go. But that's not true for everyone. And so, yeah, people were being arrested and convicted, and you know, going back to the 90s and perhaps before, some people actually being incarcerated for possession of relatively minor, back in the 70s, relatively small quantities of cannabis. So it can and has had, and I'd imagine will continue to have a devastating impact on people's lives. We should also remember, although we have legalization, there are now more laws around the cannabis plant than there were before. So what is legal is the possession of small quantities of cannabis that have been obtained, that's been obtained from a licensed producer by adults, right? So like there's still what's called illicit weed, you know, so if I had seeds or if someone had seeds from before legalization and they grew a plant, technically that would be illicit, or if it's coming from the illicit market. Young people, of course, aren't allowed to possess. There are rules around how much you can grow. And so much of the research we've seen in the United States or findings from the U.S. show that the racial disparities I've talked about actually increase after legalization or decriminalization, again, because they remain highly discretionary and drug law enforcement is so heavily tied to an intricate part of like racially biased policing anyway.
And so really, when we talk about legalization being a good thing, or we talk about it being illegal and people thinking it's legal, it really depends on who you are. Your experiences are very different depending on where you're sitting.
Absolutely. They're very different. And so for some people, this means that they can now come out of the shadows and use cannabis more openly if they were using before. I think for other people, it'll be an introduction or a reintroduction to a substance that might, you know, whether it be help them sleep or relieve anxiety. I think we'll see even more use for medicinal purposes, and we'll find out more medicinal uses for cannabis. If you're an investor or a cannabis business owner, this could have been hugely profitable and will continue to be hugely profitable. But we need to recognize, and you'd asked me earlier, you know, what do we do for the people that were harmed by prohibition? Like there are likely upwards of a half a million people in this country who still have criminal records for cannabis possession. I do work with an organization called Cannabis Amnesty. One of the first things I think we need to do is erase the criminal records of people who've been convicted of crimes that are no longer illegal.
So that's not currently underway.
Something similar, but not quite the same, as underway. The government has promised to pardon people.
What does pardoning mean?
Pardon. So I'll explain the difference. So
okay, please. Yeah.
At the moment, we have what's called a record suspension system. So if you've been convicted of a crime, you go a certain amount of time with good behavior, you can pay $641 to apply to the government for a record suspension. So this is what's commonly known as a pardon. What that means is the government basically forgives you for having done something wrong and being good since you did something wrong. But your record stays intact, and it simply indicates that your record's been suspended, your criminal record's suspended, and importantly, it can be revoked. So if you commit another crime or you're deemed to have been not of good character, I think the language is that can be reversed. So a pardon's the government forgiving you for doing something wrong. Expungement, on the other hand, is a complete erasure of those criminal records, and in a sense, the government acknowledging that it was wrong to criminalize a behavior in the first place. And so we see expungement in the case of Bill C-41 and crimes related to homosexuality. So the government's now expunging crimes of buggery, people who have convictions for, you know, crimes such as buggery, which no longer exist. So there's precedent for this. And expungement recognizes that there was a historical wrong, a profound historical wrong. And so unfortunately, the government did say that it would be forthcoming with pardons, which, you know, is a good indication that they recognize that people shouldn't be criminalized for something. But as far as I'm concerned, and we at Cannabis Amnesty are concerned, it doesn't go far enough, because these people's lives have still been impacted. And I think we should acknowledge that, you know, Justin Trudeau can stand up and tell Canadians that he's used cannabis while sitting as an MP and use that as a reason that they should elect him on a promise that he'll legalize, and then become prime minister of the country. And other people have criminal records for this, and their lives have been irreparably damaged. So amnesty is the first thing. Because so much money has gone into policing drugs and into harming neighborhoods, like we know that drug law enforcement has been concentrated in specific neighborhoods. So another part of what I would like to see is a reinvestment of some of the revenues from legal tax sales back into those communities that were most heavily policed. They're fairly easy to identify. And you go to the records such as those that were obtained by the Toronto Star, and you basically geocode the arrest data. And so you can find not only like neighborhoods, but like almost to the block level where people, where enforcement was most heavy. And then you reinvest some of that tax revenue back into social program and things like that, that we know help build healthy communities. And then finally, I think we need to ensure that people from those same communities or that have been harmed by the war on drugs are also provided access to jobs in the illicit cannabis space. So under our regime as it exists now, in order to start a cannabis company, you had to have, you know, a fair bit of business experience and a lot of capital in order to create one of these companies. Now, jobs, of course, are opening up in all different parts of the cannabis space. And I think when we look south of the border, there are places like Massachusetts and Oakland that have actually created priority licenses. So people with previous convictions have access to a special class of license to operate in the cannabis industry. People from neighborhoods that have been overpoliced have special access to licenses. And importantly, acknowledging that these people often come from backgrounds where they don't have the connections or business savvy or experience. Not only in Massachusetts are they providing preferential access to these licenses, but also skills training and things like accounting and business management, so that you can foster, you know, a business knowledge in those areas and in those people.
So these suggestions seem to really are trying to reconcile the fact that, you know, these communities were over-policed and you know, overrepresented criminally for something as simple as marijuana possession, and now, because of that criminalization, they've been left out of the market in its legalization.
Precisely. So, like, I think, you know, you're adding insult to injury when you at one time criminalize a population for doing something and then you exclude them from benefiting from its newfound legal status. And what's even worse about that is we now have not only former politicians, but importantly, police leaders in the cannabis space. So Julian Fantino, for example, who was heavily critical of cannabis as a police officer, police chief, and later a conservative politician, now runs a licensed cannabis company, right? Like, the hypocrisy there is just stunning. But the people that were arrested under his watch, or that he maybe arrested himself, are for the most part systematically excluded from that kind of benefit.
So police until you can profit, essentially.
I don't have an issue with former police officers participating in the space if opportunities also provided to the people that, you know, were criminalized as well.
Yeah. So I guess what I wonder is, what is the argument even against expungement? Like, how could you possibly make an argument that people should still have criminal records when this is now legal and our prime minister admits to smoking weed and, you know, it's now socially acceptable?
I think that's a great question. It seems like, from the indications that we're getting from the government, that expungement is reserved for profound historic injustices, and they don't see the way in which cannabis laws were enforced or the harm that was done to certain communities, and I'll say them largely Black or African Canadian and Indigenous communities. They don't see that as a profound historic injustice. And I think that's categorically wrong. I think that shows a lack of understanding of how these laws emerged and how they were enforced.
So, I mean, it seems to me, and you know, this has been called, I guess, a systemic issue. So seeing when you talk about the fact that Black and Indigenous groups are over-policed, over-represented in the criminal justice system, despite the fact that use levels are similar across the board, that would suggest that something is obviously going on that's unjust, but also systemic. And I think when we talk about systemic racism, we talk about systemic injustice. A lot of people don't know what that means. They don't know what it means for something to be systemically racist. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Sure. Like, we often differentiate as well between like systemic and institutional forms of racism.
Sure.
So like, when I think about the systemic racism present in Canadian society, I think about the fact that, you know, this was a country that was founded on a belief that Indigenous people, for example, were not full human beings and that they should be exterminated. Six of the first 16 legislators of Upper Canada owned slaves. In order to own slaves, you essentially had to view them as less than human. They were viewed as property, right? So this is a nation that's been built, that was built on ideas of racial superiority and inferiority. And of course, people, Indigenous groups that were removed from their land and put in less desirable and remote areas were not able to benefit from the resources as were those companies and those people that were given access to those lands. And so not only were these ideas prominent at the time, but our country was established in a way that certain groups benefited at the cost of others. So white Europeans benefited greatly from segregation that existed in this country up until the 1980s. Segregation was on the books in Ontario till the 1980s, and similarly in Nova Scotia. Segregation, slavery, and the treatment of the indigenous peoples, right? So those are realities that a lot of people, I think, aren't knowledgeable about. And those realities influence like both the economical, all of the economical, political, and social structures, right? The idea that certain groups are inferior and others are superior still exists. We still see a great underrepresentation of specific groups, again, Black and Indigenous peoples amongst our politicians. So those people that actually get to, you know, create laws and set policies in this country. And the same goes for the people that are running our most powerful businesses. So our country's been established in a way, and our society's still structured in a way in which some people are hugely advantaged while others are still hugely disadvantaged. And we can look at how different institutions operate, and we can look at, you know, institutionally racist practices like police carding would be one example of that. Carding was a practice of stop and documenting individuals for the purpose of information gathering. It was argued that it was like, you know, race neutral on its face because everyone had an equal likelihood of being targeted, or the police just targeted areas where crime was prevalent. But the fact of the matter was that's not actually how it was playing out, right? And then related to that, the police were stopping and documenting largely or disproportionately Black and brown young men in the city of Toronto. The police also have hiring policies and practices that had historically excluded people that had contact with the police from joining the ranks, right? So this policing practice that wasn't supposed to be discriminatory, although it was, then had the effect of excluding the people that it was targeting from working for the police force. And so with these types of policies, right, that appear to be race neutral, for example, those hiring policies, anyone that's known to police or with a criminal record, you know, should, according to the old policies, face an additional level of scrutiny. But if policing practices are racially disparate or discriminatory, then that other seemingly race neutral practice also, by extension, is discriminatory and exclusionary.
And does this create distrust between the police and the communities that are over-policed? I can't imagine that, you know, you think you're going to have a good interaction with a cop when you've only had bad ones.
Listeners couldn't see me roll my eyes.
Okay, let the record show there was an eye roll.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the extremely detrimental outcomes of like discriminatory policing, like those people that are stopped and searched and repeatedly stopped and searched know that they're disproportionately targeted. They know that they're the targets. I think it's amongst the most damaging for people that are law abiding and still repeatedly stopped and searched because of what they look like and where they live. And we know, like our research demonstrates and research that I've been involved in shows, that people who are stopped and searched and who feel that that was unjust have overall more negative views of the police and the remainder of the justice system, and importantly of other social institutions too, right? So their experiences with the police for many aren't completely disentangled from discriminatory experiences they might have had either in the educational systems or in the workforce. And so it becomes part of a broader view of living a socially unjust life. And some of the same works showing, you know, that people who feel negatively about the police and feel that they've been the victim of police discrimination are less likely to cooperate, of course, as like witnesses, victims, or the accused. So when the police say, oh, you know, we can't get information from witnesses and, you know, people aren't snitching, it's like, well, they don't trust you because you abuse them and then you want them to talk to you. Less likely to obey police authority, less likely to cooperate, and importantly, actually, less likely to obey the law as well. And so perceptions of injustice can actually increase criminal behavior.
Okay, so it ends up going full circle, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And it's not working.
No, as Justice Michael Tulloch recently said in his review of the practice of police carding, for example, that like discriminatory police carding has a negative impact on public safety. Because for the very reasons I've said, people disengage from law enforcement, and also it increases the likelihood that, you know, if they don't see the system as fair, why are they going to abide by that system's rules?
Right. But I mean, are there also other reasons why you might see certain groups more represented in the criminal justice system. For example, being overrepresented in poverty, and, you know, how do you consider that being kind of related to this? And how can we kind of talk about this in a way where we understand why certain groups might be more likely to commit certain crimes, but also that there's a larger context to that? Because we see a lot of right-wing kind of pundits say, well, you know, there's more Black people represented in certain crimes, and so that's why they're over-policed. And, you know, you speak of the larger reasons of that. Maybe talk about those.
That's, I think, a great question. Like, I think the thing to acknowledge off the bat is, like, there's no race/crime gene. When you look across different nations and across the globe, the more political instability and the more social inequality you have, the more likely you are to have crime. So you look at, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, for example, the more politically unstable and more unequal societies have higher levels of crime in countries that are largely homogeneously Black. But that's not to say that there aren't social conditions that are conducive to crime, especially the types of crime that the police pay attention to. So street crimes and crimes of violence. And so absolutely, I think we would see racial differences in participation in certain types of crime. White collar crime, for example, is going to be a heavily white crime because of the individuals that are in positions to commit that crime, right?
And under policed.
And it is hugely under policed. But on the other end of that spectrum, right, if we know that Indigenous and African Canadian people, for example, are more likely to experience poverty, to be politically and economically marginalized, then it makes sense that those groups are going to face an increased likelihood those are criminogenic factors, I should say. So the vast majority of Indigenous and African Canadian people in this country are not criminal, contrary to what, you know, some pundits would believe. But they do run an elevated risk of engaging in certain types of behaviors because of their experiences, not only with like poverty and marginalization, but actually discrimination itself too. And so it's nice to see, for example, in Ontario, we're seeing a move, as we have in Nova Scotia, to an acknowledgement of this in criminal sentencing. So judges in Ontario, as they have been in Nova Scotia for some time, are now taking anti-Black racism into consideration in the sentencing of African-Canadian offenders, acknowledging that they're greatly overrepresented in correctional facilities and that this is due to the historical and contemporary discrimination that African Canadians have faced and the impact that that has on their participation in crime, combined with the fact that we know that the justice system is discriminatory, that Black people are more likely to be stopped and searched, less likely to benefit from positive police discretion, probably more likely to be convicted in court and sentenced more heavily than comparable white offenders. And when sentenced, they receive higher risk assessment scores in the correctional institutions and are less likely to receive parole. And so these are very much cyclical because, of course, you know, criminalization reproduces those very conditions of poverty and disassociation from mainstream society that create crime in the first place, right? They're what we call the collateral consequences of criminalization or of incarceration.
And so I see kind of a deep connection between the failures of the war on drugs. You know, if the goal is to stop use, to stop trafficking, the war on drugs has largely been a failure by those measures. But could the same be said of then the policing of a lot of crime, in that it doesn't actually address any of the root causes of some of these crimes? In fact, it just kind of reinforces, and we see these kind of cyclical patterns of poverty, of crime reproducing themselves.
So as I start off saying, right, I teach in a sociology department, and so I come at this from a sociological perspective. Some psychologists might disagree, but to agree with what you're saying, yes. And I think actually many police officers and police leaders would acknowledge that we can't police our way out of crime and crime issues that we might see. The criminal justice system is the last in a long line of social institutions, and it's largely general failures in society and failures of those other social institutions that create a set of problems that we then leave the police to deal with. So we're certainly not going to arrest our way out of drug use generally, especially not recreational use, people just wanting to have some fun. I walk by the LCBO just down the road every day and see people going in. Some of those are using recreationally, some of those using because they have problems. We're also not going to police our way out of problematic illicit drug use, right? Those are issues that have to do with, you know, trauma and problems associated perhaps with mental health when it is truly problematic drug use, and the police aren't equipped to or positioned to deal with that. And so, yes, the same goes for other types of crime. We're not going to police our way out of crimes of poverty. That very much does, as you've noted, just dig us into a deeper hole.
Right. I want to kind of bring us back to talking about drugs, because we love talking about drugs. You've also advocated, so obviously you support the legalization of marijuana and also the reparations that you talked about. You've also advocated the legalization of all recreational drugs. Can you talk about that? Why should we do this?
Sure. For the same reasons as cannabis, like I recognize the dangers associated with the use of many drugs, right? I certainly don't want people to think that I'm in favor of, you know, drugs for everyone and that they should be available next to the Skittles at the counter at the local convenience store. But I think we need to think seriously about, as we've said, this failure of the war on drugs to curtail use. The United States has had some of the harsher drug laws, certainly in the West. It's also the largest consumer of cocaine. And so if drug laws worked, there shouldn't be any cocaine in that country. But they don't, because need outstrips, or demand outstrips, any ability to curtail it's getting into the country. But I do think that these harms of criminalization that I've talked about, like if we think about someone who's got a serious drug problem, is arresting that person, locking them up, and then releasing them with a criminal record, having estranged them from their family and their community, going to help that problematic use? I don't think so. I think that we need to take a public health approach to drug use, which is would focus on harm reduction. So allowing people access to a safe, regulated supply of a substance that would be regulated by the government, and I would think also made available through government-run stores. So I see a situation in which an individual, if they wanted to get a drug, whether that be, you know, cocaine or psilocybin, magic mushrooms, MDMA, heroin, if they were of a certain age, would be able to go into a pharmacy, essentially, and get a certain amount of that drug to use, perhaps under the supervision of a healthcare professional. So we see safe injection sites in different places across the country, and we know that those safe injection sites result in a reduction in drug-related overdoses and deaths in the areas around those. And so I think that if we were to take such an approach, there's certainly a risk that drug use may increase amongst some populations, but I do believe that if we provide people access not only to a clean, regulated supply of drugs, but also to the supports they might need to reduce or eliminate that use, if they so chose, would be a lot more beneficial for those individuals and for our society than simply criminalizing them and treating drug use and problematic drug use as if it were a problem that a criminal record or incarceration is going to deal with, because it's not.
Doesn't seem to be working.
It doesn't seem to be working, does it? Exactly. Especially not when our prisons are also full of drugs.
Right. Well, I wonder how you consider this, just in relation to what we've seen going on over the last few years with the opioid crisis and the rise in opiate-related deaths. You know, we've seen increases in instances of fentanyl and drugs that are really killing people. How do you kind of reconcile that with you know, your position on, mm-hmm. on legalizing?
So let me just have you go back and also say that, like, criminalizing drugs also creates space for an illicit market. Right. And so having drugs are so expensive because they're illegal, and there's a high level of risk involved in getting those drugs to market. And so people are willing to engage in those, in the trafficking of drugs for those huge profits. But that also comes with high levels of violence. So we see that not only in, like, the local context, but certainly in the international context. And so we can look at what's been happening in Mexico, you know, up until very recently, for example, and other parts of South and Central America and around the world. So not only, I think, do we have to consider the harm that criminalization does to individuals, but also in the larger context, too, in terms of what having an illicit market enables and what that does. And that's, you know, supports, and this is part of why we legalized cannabis, or part of why the government said they would want to legalize cannabis, was to take share away from the illicit players in those markets.
And so is there evidence to, you know, maybe in other places where it's been legalized, or, you know, is there reason to believe that the black market will be made smaller by legalization?
I prefer the term illicit market.
Oh, okay, sorry. Illicit market.
There's been a bit of a debate going on about this recently.
Why is that?
Well, because like a lot of negative things are associated with the word black and
oh,
black people,
true.
Right?
Yeah, okay, so that's true. That's true.
A senator who questioned the government's use of, or some individuals' use of the term black market. Muhammad Ali has a good piece on that if you ever want to take a look at the power. Language is a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'd ask me if there's evidence that making a substance legal reduces black the illicit market. Absolutely. We see that with tobacco. Pricing's important, right? So quality and price have to be right in order to take share away from the illicit players in a market.
Right.
You'd asked another question and now I'd forgotten.
It was about the,
the
opioid.
The legal. Yeah, the opioid.
Well, the opioid crisis. I'm just wondering how that plays into.
So as I said, I think strictly controlled and regulated and informing people about the dangers of use, right? Like, sure, like opioids were made legal, but we had the opposite of what I'm proposing in terms of how our pharmaceutical companies became the biggest drug dealers in the world, largely, right? And when you've got these for-profit companies, and this would, of course, be a risk, playing the game as they were, like they've got such an incentive to get the drugs out to users, and they were essentially bribing doctors to prescribe these drugs. And so I think like that was... I can't call that an illicit market gone wrong because, of course, it was illicit, but there was actually a lot of illicit activity, I would say, going on there. But that was there was a lack of regulation and oversight there, and that's part of why we have the problem that we're seeing now. And then also, I would say that dealing with those the very issues, as I've said, that caused substance abuse, there weren't those supports. So I think, you know, Portugal's decriminalized drugs generally, and Portugal's often pointed to as a good model of how you can stop criminalizing people and provide them with supports they need to control, manage, or eliminate drug use if that's their choice. Because one of the first things I did this morning when I got up was consumed a substance, right? Like I put on the kettle and I made a pot
what
of coffee.
Was it?
Right? I had another one actually when I walked in here. I just finished this nice coffee that you made me as well. We allow people to use certain substances. I could make myself probably quite ill if I drank too much of that, or if I walked to a local store and I bought a pack or a carton of cigarettes and decided to sit down and have all of those, I'd make myself quite sick. And we know that the tobacco again and alcohol, like alcohol is something I could literally walk to a store down the road and get enough to kill myself without anyone, you know, batting an eye at doing that. And so again, it's not necessarily that we want to eliminate all use, but I think we want people generally to be relatively safe and protect their health, and that, you know, is good for them and good for, in a country like this, the rest of us as well that pay taxes to support our healthcare system.
And so ultimately it seems to come down to, for you, the benefits outweigh the cost to, you know, legalization of recreational drugs. Yeah.
Yeah, the benefits outweigh the costs, precisely.
And so obviously we talked about the kind of reparations that you're asking for people who have been criminalized for marijuana possession. I'm wondering, do you also support expungement for other recreational drugs?
I do, especially for possession, but also for small scale trafficking. And this is, you know, me speaking as an academic, as someone who studies these issues, right? Like for many people, for some people in some areas, the trafficking of drugs seems like amongst the most viable options in terms of jobs, right? For people who we know are systematically excluded from the labor market, the trafficking of drugs, again, seems like a viable job, viable career option or job option, even though it, for most people, is not actually very lucrative. I was asked, so we talk about pardons or expungement here in the Canadian context. One of the potential obstacles to expungement is that drug that people have been convicted of possessing is not always noted so very clearly in their records. So sometimes it just says, you know, that they've contravened the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, that they've possessed a drug. It doesn't necessarily say exactly what that drug was, even though cannabis has its own schedule. And also people sometimes plea down. So they might have been possessing for the purpose of trafficking and then just get a possession charge. I don't see what harm we'd really be doing to our society if we just blanket cleared everyone who had a criminal record for drug possession's criminal record. Like really, right. Is drug possession that bad a crime that we wouldn't want the people who've been convicted of that to have a decent shot at the types of things that you and I perhaps take for granted, which is getting decent housing, being able to get a job, and being able to travel? We're seeing increasingly now, you know, the Ottawa police, for example, has partnered with large local landlords to run background checks on potential renters in private rental buildings, right? So it's not just, we often hear about public renters, so housing corporations, state-run housing corporations, not allowing people with criminal records to rent and evicting people when they get criminal records or members of their family do. We're now seeing this moving into the private realm as well, and I find that hugely troubling.
So, you know, just to put that in some concrete terms, you get charged for possession of magic mushrooms or cocaine or MDMA, and that could stop you from getting housing.
Or you have illicit cannabis because you decided to go into one of the dispensaries that's still running in the city rather than get it from the OCS or the Ontario Cannabis Store website. We've got to remember, to buy cannabis in Ontario right now, you have to have a credit card, because you're buying it online from the government, right?
Right.
So that automatically excludes people who don't have credit cards. So, like, if we want to talk about, like, systemic forms of discrimination, access to cannabis in this province right now is somewhat limited to people who are privileged enough to have a credit card. So that's not only the banked, but that's the credited as well.
It's not available to everybody.
It's not available to everybody, at least not legally.
So I want to ask you, just because, and I don't know if you want to speak to this or you can speak to this, but how do your perspectives on recreational drug policy differ from libertarian views? Because I know libertarians believe that it's immoral for the government to dictate what substances a person is able to consume. That doesn't seem to be the position where you're coming from, but can you kind of talk about the differences?
Well, like, so I'm not saying my view is libertarian, but I think when we think about the potential harm that a substance has, like, I do think that the government, in a sense, should limit people's ability to harm themselves and especially other people, right? So that's where we would differ. Like, I guess libertarians and I are just aligned on the fact that I don't think the government should be stopping people from using these things if they want to. Like,
right.
That's where it comes in. Yeah, but, you know, I don't come at this from a, like, get the government out of my life perspective. That's not true. I do. It's like, stop the government from screwing with people's lives because of the negative impact that it's having, right? So,
but it sounds like you still see a role for the government, perhaps in administrative services.
No, absolutely. I see a role for the government in this. It's just, it's not telling us what not to do. It's like ensuring or enabling us to do it in a more safe manner.
And not in policing.
No. Right. Get in the business of sales.
Yeah, get in the business of sales. And the other piece to this is, like, is any of this really addressing, you know, if we were to, you know, all of these recreational drugs we've talked about are illegal, but is anybody talking about the reasons why people are doing drugs? Maybe it's fun. Maybe it's to escape their lives. You know, are we really even talking about the deeper issues?
Well, I don't think we are enough in certain places, in certain circles. We are definitely like, you might have heard of, like, Gabor Maté, for example, who's got some quite good popular books on drug use and why people engage in problematic drug use behaviors. He might be one of the better known Canadians writing on this. I think when we think about use, let's start with cannabis. Like, we're often worried about people's use because it might produce psychosis, for example. I think there's been a lot of attention to that. I think there's been less attention, perhaps, to the escapism that the drugs used for amongst some problematic users, or maybe non-problematic users as well. If some people can escape over a bottle of wine, why not over a bong load or something like that? But I don't necessarily think that we are having enough of a discussion generally about why people use drugs. You know, Maté talks about just the huge amount of trauma that he sees in the people with the most problematic drug use disorders that he deals with, right? And I think that, you know, trauma is not something that we discuss enough in our society anyway. You know, we just had Bell's Let's Talk Day, which thankfully is getting a fair bit of criticism, because I think there needs to be more action and less talking. There needs to be more talking, but there needs to be more action as well. And I think that the trauma and the impact that has on people's lives and the types of behaviors people engage in when they've been or when they've experienced trauma would be a good starting point in that respect.
I want you to think about something for a moment. Pretend that we are living in times of alcohol prohibition, and you were caught with a small amount of alcohol, and now you have a criminal record for that. Now prohibition is over, but you still have that criminal record, despite the fact that
what you did is no longer a crime. There are upwards of 500,000 people in Canada with cannabis possession charges on their record. Having this on your record can impact your life in so many ways. It can impact your ability to travel, your ability to volunteer, to find employment, to get an apartment, to be accepted into certain university programs. It can have a detrimental impact on your chances at any sort of social mobility. The Liberal government has introduced a bill to pardon people who have cannabis possession offenses, but pardoning is not enough. This legislation will waive the $631 pardoning application fee and, if granted, forgive someone of a crime and suspend their record. But it doesn't fully erase it. Certain police agencies can still access that record. A pardon can be revoked by a subsequent government. It can be revoked by the parole board. Expungement completely wipes away and destroys the record. It recognizes that the government was wrong to criminalize this in the first place, and this can't be revoked. There are no takebacks for expungement. Cannabis Amnesty is calling for full expungement of these records, and people like Seth Rogen have publicly supported this. Important to note that this has recently actually been done in San Francisco. San Francisco's district attorney, George Gascon, recently partnered with a nonprofit organization in the U.S. called Code for America, and they were actually able to expunge over 8,000 convictions at once, going back to 1975. And the really good thing about expungement is that people don't have to jump through hoops to get rid of a criminal record for something that is now already legal. So if you, like me and Seth Rogen, think that we should be pursuing expungement rather than pardons, then please go to cannabisamnesty.ca/email. It's super easy. You can put in your postal code and it will automatically set you up to email your member of parliament and other important people in government so you can support expungement. And an NDP member of parliament named Murray Rankin actually recently introduced a private member's bill, Bill C-415, that supports this motion. And it's going to be voted on in Parliament on May 2nd. So get your voice out there, talk to your MP. I think putting pressure might actually work. Sometimes we can feel very paralyzed to change anything, but this is something you can actually do. So go to cannabisamnesty.ca/email. I'm Maggie Reed, and you've been listening to Lowercase Truth. If you want to subscribe to this podcast, you can visit our website at lowercasetruthpodcast.com or subscribe on whatever platform you use to access sounds. iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, etc. Until next time.